Hugo Carmody had been looking forward to a tête-à-tête with Percy Pilbeam. Coming across him in the drawing-room before dinner, he found Percy in a strange mood, possibly the result of four of Beach's cocktails which the sleuth had imbibed. "I don't know if you're aware of it, worm," he said, "but you came jolly near to blighting my life."
"How did I blight your life, Carmody?"
"You didn't."
"You said I did."
"I said you tried to."
"Make up your mind, Carmody."
"Don't keep calling me Carmody."
"But Carmody," protested Pilbeam, "it's your name, isn't it?"
"Certainly it is."
"Then why try to hash it up, Carmody? Be frank and open. I don't mind people knowing my name. I glory in it. It's Pilbeam, Pilbeam, Pilbeam. That's what it is. Pilbeam."
"In about 30 seconds," said Hugo, "it'll be mud." It struck Percy Pilbeam for the first time that in his companion's manner there was a certain peevishness.
"Something the matter?" he asked, concerned.
"Confide in me.
I like your face."
He settled himself in a deep armchair, and putting the tips of his fingers together, after a little preliminary difficulty in making them meet, leaned back, all readiness to listen to whatever trouble it was that was disturbing this new friend of his. "Some days ago, insect, I called at your office, and after we had talked of this and that, I left. I discovered later that immediately upon my departure you had set your foul spies on my trail and had instructed them to take notes of my movements and report on them, the result being that I came jolly close to having my bally life ruined. And if you want to know what I'm going to do, I'm going to haul you out of that chair and turn you round and kick you hard and go on kicking you till I kick you out of the house." Pilbeam unclosed his eyes.
"Nothing," he said, "could be fairer than that. Nevertheless, that's no reason why you should go about stealing pigs."
Hugo had often read stories in which people reeled and would have fallen had they not clutched at whatever it was they clutched at. He had never expected to undergo that experience himself.
"What do you mean?" he said thickly.
Pilbeam's eyes opened.
"What do I mean? What do I... what do you think I mean? I mean you're a pig pincher, that's what I mean. You go to and fro sneaking pigs and hiding them in caravans."
"Did you see me?"
"What say, Carmody?"
"Did you see me put that pig in the caravan?"
"Certainly I saw you, Carmody. Why shouldn't I see you? Considering I'd been caught in the rain and taken shelter in the caravan and was in there with my trousers off, trying to dry them because I am subject to lumbago."
Hugo was experiencing the bitterness which comes to all criminals who discover too late that they have undone themselves by trying to be too clever. It had seemed at the time such a good idea to remove the Empress from the gamekeeper's cottage in the Westwood and place her in Baxter's caravan, where nobody would think of looking. How could he have anticipated that the caravan would be bulging with blighted detectives? At this tense moment, the door opened and Beach appeared.
"I beg your pardon, sir, but do you propose to wait any longer for Mr. Ronald?"
"Eh?"
"Certainly not," said Pilbeam. "Who the devil's Mr. Ronald, I should like to know? I didn't come to this place to do a fast cure. I want my dinner, and I want it now. And if Mr. Ronald doesn't like it, he can do the other thing."
He strode in a dominating manner to the door.
"Come along, Carmody, din-dins."
Hugo had sunk into a chair. "I don't want any dinner," he said dully.
"You don't want any dinner?"
"No."
"No dinner?"
"No." Pilbeam shrugged his shoulders impatiently. "Man's an ass," he said. And he headed for the stairs. His manner seemed to indicate that he had washed his hands of Hugo. Beach lingered.
"Shall I bring you some sandwiches, sir?"
"No, thanks." "What was that?" A loud crash had sounded. The butler went to the door and looked out.
"It is Mr. Pilbeam, sir.
He appears to have fallen downstairs." For an instant, a look of hope crept into Hugo's careworn face. "Has he broken his neck?"
"Apparently not, sir."
"Ah," said Hugo regretfully. The efficient Baxter had retired to the smoking room shortly before 7:30. He desired silence and solitude. Then, from the direction of the hall, there came a new sound, faint at first, but swelling and swelling to a frenzied blare, seeming to throb through the air with a note of passionate appeal like woman wailing for her demon lover. It was the dressing for dinner gong. Baxter did not stir. The summons left him unmoved. He did not propose to go in to dinner. He wanted to be alone with his thoughts. They were not the sort of thoughts with which most men would have wished to be left alone, being both dark and bitter. That expedition to the gamekeeper's cottage in the Westwood had not proved a pleasure trip for Rupert Baxter. Reviewing it in his mind, he burned with baffled rage. And yet everybody had been very nice to him, very nice and tactful. At the moment of the discovery that the cottage contained no pig and appeared to have been pigless from its foundation, Lord Emsworth had talked soothingly about light and shade effects. He'd said, and Beach agreed with him, that in the darkness of a thunderstorm, anybody might have been deceived into supposing that he had seen a butler feeding a pig in the gamekeeper's cottage. It was probably, said Lord Emsworth, and Beach thought so too, a bit of wood sticking out of the wall or something. He had concluded by advising Baxter, and Beach said the suggestion was a good one, to hurry home and have a nice cup of hot tea and go to bed. His attitude, in short, could not have been pleasanter or more considerate. Yet Baxter, as he sat in the smoking room, burned, as stated, with baffled rage. The door handle turned. Beach stood on the threshold.
"If you have changed your mind, sir, about taking dinner, the meal is quite ready."
He spoke as a friend. There was nothing in his manner to suggest that the man he addressed had ever accused him of stealing pigs. As far as Beach was concerned, all was forgotten and forgiven.
"I don't want any dinner."
"Very good, sir."
"Bring me that whiskey and soda, quick."
"Yes, sir."
Presently the refreshments arrived, carried by James the footman. James placed them gently on the table, shot a swift glance of respectful commiseration at the patient, and passed away. Baxter resumed his meditations. For a time, these dealt exclusively with a recent past, and were, in consequence, of a morbid character. Then, as the grateful glow of the whiskey began to make itself felt, a softer mood came to Rupert Baxter. His mind turned to thoughts of Sue. Baxter approved of Sue. We cannot say more. But this approval added to the fact that he had been informed by Lady Constance that the girl was the only daughter of a man who possessed $60 million, had been enough to cause him to earmark her in his mind as the future Mrs. Baxter. In that capacity, he had docketed her and filed her away at the first moment of their meeting. Naturally, therefore, the remarks which Lord Emsworth had let fall in her hearing had caused him grave concern. It hampers a man in his wooing if the girl he has selected for his bride starts with the idea that he is as mad as a coot. He congratulated himself on the promptitude with which he had handled the situation. That letter which he had written her could not fail to put him right in her eyes. In fact, it seemed to him that he could almost hear the wedding bells ringing already. Then, coming out of his dreams, he realized that it was the telephone. He reached for the instrument with a frown, annoyed at the interruption, and spoke with an irritated sharpness.
"Hello. Blandings Castle?"
"Yes."
"Post Office Market Blandings speaking. Telegram for Lady Constance Keble."
"I will take it."
"Lady Constance Keble, Blandings Castle, Market Blandings, Shropshire, England," said the voice. "Handed in at Paris."
"Where?"
"Paris, France."
"Oh. Well?"
"Terribly sorry. Hear news. Stop. So disappointed, shall be unable come to you later as going back America at end of month. Stop. Do hope we shall be able arrange something when I return next year. Stop. Regards. Stop."
"Yes?"
"Signed, Myra Schoonmaker."
Baxter's mouth had fallen open. The forehead above the spectacles was wrinkled, the eyes behind them staring blankly and with a growing horror. He hung up the receiver. His brain was numbed. Myra Schoonmaker telegraphing from Paris? Then who was this girl who was at the castle calling herself by that preposterous name? An imposter, an adventuress? She must be. And if he made a move to expose her, she would revenge herself by showing Lord Emsworth that letter of his. That letter! He must recover it. He must recover it at once. As long as it remained in the girl's possession, it was a pistol pointed at his head. Once let Lord Emsworth become acquainted with those very frank criticisms of himself which it contained, and not even his ally, Lady Constance, would be able to restore him to his lost secretaryship, and Baxter yearned to be back at Blandings Castle in the position he had once enjoyed. At all costs, he must recover that letter, and the present moment, he perceived, was ideal for the venture. The girl must have the thing in her room somewhere, and for the next hour at least she would be in the dining room. He would have ample opportunity for a search. He did not delay. 30 seconds later, he was mounting the stairs, his face set, his spectacles gleaming grimly. A minute later, he reached his destination. The door was ajar. He pushed it open and went in. Blandings Castle, like most places of its size and importance, contained bedrooms so magnificent that they were never used. Of the guest rooms still in commission, the most luxurious was that which had been given to Sue. At the moment when Baxter stole cautiously in, it was looking its best in the gentle evening light. But Baxter was not in sightseeing mood. He ignored the carved bedstead, the cosy armchairs, the pictures, the decorations, and the soft carpet into which his feet sank. The beauty of the sky through the French windows that gave onto the balcony drew but a single brief glance from him. Without delay, he made for the writing desk which stood against the wall near the bed. There were several pigeonholes in the desk, but not one of them contained the fatal letter. The drawer of the dressing table now suggested itself as a possibility. He left the desk and made his way towards it. It stood so near to the open window that the breeze was ruffling the tassels on its lampshades, and Baxter, arriving in front of it, was enabled for the first time to see the balcony in its entirety. And as he saw it, his heart seemed to sideslip. Leaning upon the parapet and looking out over the sea of gravel that swept up to the front door from the rhododendron-fringed drive, stood a girl. And not even the fact that her back was turned could prevent Baxter identifying her. He had assumed, as a matter of course, that Sue was down in the dining room, and it took him several seconds to adjust his mind to the unpleasing fact that she was up on her balcony. There was nothing for it, he realized, but to give up his quest and go. He started to tiptoe silently to the door, and had just reached it, when, from the other side, there came to his ears a sound of chinking and clattering. The sound, in fact, which is made by plates and dishes when they are carried on a tray to a guest who has asked her hostess if she may take dinner in her room. As the door handle turned, Rupert Baxter, even in this black hour efficient, dropped on all fours and slid under the bed as smoothly as if he'd been practicing for weeks. The first sound that came to Rupert Baxter was that made by the placing of the tray on the table. Then, after a pause, a pair of squeaking shoes passed over the carpet and squeaked out of hearing. Baxter recognized them as those of Footman Thomas, a confirmed squeaker. After this, somebody puffed, causing him to deduce the presence of Beach.
"Your dinner is quite ready, miss."
"Oh, thank you." The girl had apparently come in from the balcony. A chair scraped to the table. "Oh, it looks very good."
"I trust you will enjoy it, miss. Is there anything further that I can do for you?"
No, thank you, no. Oh, yes, would you mind fetching that manuscript from the balcony? I was reading it out there, and I left it on the chair. It's Mr. Threepwood's book."
"Indeed, miss. An exceedingly interesting compilation, I should imagine."
"Oh, yes, very."
"I wonder if it would be taking a liberty, miss, to ask you to inform me later, at your leisure, if I make any appearance in its pages."
"You?"
"Yes, miss. From what Mr. Galahad has let fall from time to time, I fancy it was his intention to give me printed credit as his authority for certain of the stories which appear in the book."
"Do you want to be in it?"
"Most decidedly, miss. I should consider it an honour. And it would please my mother."
"Have you a mother, Beach?"
Yes, miss. She lives at Eastbourne."
The butler moved majestically onto the balcony, and Sue's mind had turned to speculation about his mother and whether she looked anything like him, when there was a sound of hurrying feet without. The door flew open, and Beach's mother passed from her mind like the unsubstantial fabric of a dream. With a little choking cry, she rose to her feet. Ronnie was standing before her.